This is
Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, almost overran the beginning again. This is Port of Harlem Talk Radio, and I'm your host for this show and also publisher of Port of Harlem Magazine at portofharlem.net. If you're listening via the internet, you can type your questions in the comment box. You can also call and listen by dialing on your phone, 516-531-9540. And if you want to ask a question after you are connected, press 1, and please be in a quiet place. You can also visit portofharlem.net and click Port of Harlem Talk Radio from the menu to hear this and past episodes. We are also available on about 7 podcast platforms. And lastly, We Talk Productions sponsors Port of Harlem Talk Radio. Our guest today is Ron James Jr., and he is here largely to unravel the importance of Ketanji Brown Jackson and Candace Jackson Akinwumi appointments and the future of the United States Supreme Court. James, our guest, is a graduate of Yale University and Duke University School of Law. He's a former D.C. Assistant Attorney General and has practiced law for 2 decades in Washington, D.C. He is also the author of 3 books. One is called Root and Branch, Charles Hamilton Houston, Thurgood Marshall and the Struggle to End Segregation, The Double V, How Wars, Protests, and Harry and Truman Desegregated America's Military, and finally, The Truman Court, Law and the Limits of Loyalty. Welcome, Ron. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. Thank you very much for having me, Wayne.
Yeah, and I hope that you really help us understand what's going on and hopefully the importance of these appointments or the lack of importance, whatever we end up getting to. But my first question to you is, what makes President Biden's appointment of Ketanji Brown Jackson to the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia so monumental?
Well, the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia is the most simple and accurate way to put it is it's the second most important federal court in the United States. And this is because the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals reviews the closest controversies among the federal agencies and many of the controversies of individuals and organizations suing the United States government. Many of the most important cases that reach the court have been previously decided at the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. Even whether or not the Supreme Court decides to accept those cases have been argued at the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. So it truly is a very important court that is really getting renewed attention with the nomination and confirmation of Judge Brown Jackson.
So you're saying that all courts are not equal. All court of appeals are not equal.
They are in their power to resolve cases. What makes the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals different is its jurisdiction, the kind of cases that end up there. And so that its power is the same, but the cases that those judges review tend to be cases that affect a larger segment of the United States population, often can affect the entire United States population as we're dealing with cases involving the entire federal government. And so then their power of appellate review is the same, but the cases that they are reviewing are tend to be of large significance.
So it's the impact of the court itself that gives her more power or makes her appointment more impactful.
That will be coming through the front door or what make every judge on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals an important judge. All the Article III judges, they're lifetime appointments, and they have, even at the federal district level, as we often see when they halt presidential orders, the Article III judges are extremely powerful in our system of government and the way we operate it today, and they all have a great deal of power. At the appellate level, though, the cases that come to the D.C. Circuit tend to be ones that affect a larger number of all of us American citizens.
The other little word you said in there that I caught on to, and hopefully you will take time to explain that, to stretch that out a little bit more, is that you said when the appellate court from D.C. gets a case that's more impactful than, say, the other appellate courts, that they may make a decision and the Supreme Court let it stand. So in effect, it makes a decision for the Supreme Court.
Yes, that is true. And that happens, to be sure, the Supreme Court accepts a very small percentage of the cases that are appealed to the Supreme Court. It requires four justices. The vote of four justices are required for the court to accept the case, to grant certiorari.
You're talking about four justices on the Supreme Court for the Supreme Court to accept a case.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I'll be more clear. Yes, but four justices of the Supreme Court must vote to grant certiorari or review to hear a case. And the vast majority of cases that are appealed to the Supreme Court are not granted certiorari for a whole host of reasons. Those of us, many of us here in Washington especially, tend to look at the tea leaves and try to figure out why, you know, this certain case was not granted certiorari when we thought that it would be. There are some standard, I wouldn't call them rules, but customs that lend cases to Supreme Court review. And the big one is if there's what we call a split in the circuits. So if the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals rules one way on something and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals out in California and on the West Coast rules a different way, and they have two very different opinions, and then let's say the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in the Midwest, where Judge Candace Jackson Akinwumi has just been confirmed, if that comes in and kind of takes one side and not the other, then attorneys will go to the Supreme Court and say, if the issue is significant enough, that justices, you need to come in and decide what the law is here.
Wow. So it's much more complex than just having a court case on Perry Mason or any other new court case show. All right. It's a little bit more complicated.
That's right. Okay. And a great deal of the court's power is in its ability to deny hearing cases. Congress granted the court that power to determine much of its own docket early in the 20th century, early in the last century. And that is one of the most important powers that the court has. To decide what it is going to decide.
Right. So is the appointment of Candace, you just mentioned the other lady too, Candace Jackson Akinwumi, is her appointment to the United States Circuit Judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Court in Chicago, is that in the same league as Brown Jackson's appointment?
It is entirely on par. They are exactly equal in rank according to the Constitution and according to the law. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals is all the circuits are important, but the Seventh Circuit is an interesting circuit and carries a great deal of influence because it is not as clearly historically, it's not been as clearly ideologically bound as some of the other circuits have been. So, for example, the Ninth Circuit, which the previous president enjoyed talking about so much, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals tends to lean toward the left on questions of the law. The Fourth Circuit, which is in North Carolina, Virginia, Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in Louisiana and Texas, they tend, generally speaking, to lean more toward the right. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, historically speaking, well, I'm speaking over a period of generations here, generally has kind of been in the middle, literally in the country and in the ideology. And so attorneys often look to the Seventh Circuit and other judges look to the Seventh Circuit opinions as well to read them very closely. It is an influential court in no small part because of that reason.
That is so deep. So can you explain to me the soundbite of more? why would we have, I guess, these different circuit courts? They equal technically, but they come out and have different personalities.
Yes, their personalities reflect the jurisdictions where the bench sits, and so the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals is in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin, and that's a very different jurisdiction than California, Oregon, and Washington State. So if you've got the senators from those states in a room, you'd have different opinions. If you got just random people at a gas station, they likely would have different opinions about things. And so it's part of how we allow our Article III judges, who are appointed for life, once confirmed by the Senate, it's part of how we allow them, enforce them in some way, compel them to represent the jurisdictions in which they reside.
Wow, that's just significant. When we post such information on Facebook, such as what we hope to do here, and hopefully in the article in Port of Harlem, I sometimes baffle at a few readers who respond as if President Biden is somehow expected to appoint a black woman to the Supreme Court right now. What do you say to such people about the process and traditions that we just discussed when it comes to filling the Supreme Court and the appointment of Brown Jackson to the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia?
I see that almost as two parts. First is just the process, and that it has been some long time since a president has nominated someone to the court who has not been either a judge or been the Solicitor General of the United States. And the Solicitor General is the attorney who represents the Department of Justice before the Supreme Court. So, for example, Justice Elena Kagan was the Solicitor General. And before that, she was the Charles Hamilton Houston chair, professor at Harvard Law School, and then later the dean of Harvard Law School. It has been some time since a president has reached out and picked someone who had not had had judicial experience or been this Solicitor General to jump directly to the Supreme Court. So there is a bit of process in this, and it's just a matter of expectation, what each generation expects, and this is what we expect, even if the person goes to a circuit court of appeals just for a cup of coffee. I mean, Justice Clarence Thomas was nominated to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and it was just about by the time he unpacked all his books in his office, he's called to Kennebunkport, Maine, to be nominated for the to be Supreme Court Justice. There is a bit of process that that generally is followed right now. And the process changes through generations, but where we are right now, someone is not going to come from private practice. It'd be hard-pressed, I'd say. The nomination would be hard-pressed to get through for someone to come from private practice straight through to being on the court. Now, of course, someone would say, well, what about Chief Justice Roberts? But he's a different thing, and he did do his time not just on the bench, but also in the administration as well of President Reagan. The second point, if I may, of your question got to Biden and his pledge during the campaign to nominate an African-American woman to the Supreme Court. And he was largely praised for doing this. My opinion is I understand why he did it, not just the political ramifications of it. It's a political move. He's in campaign season trying to get votes, and the most reliable Democratic voters are African-American women, and he needed them to turn out. But my concern is that it does an eventual disservice to the nominees. And that when one reviews the resume of Judge Candace Jackson Akinwumi and Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, I've reviewed both their presentations to the Senate, where they have to present their papers, their resumes. It's a big 50-page dossier that they have to present to the Senate, and it's the public documents. Their records are impeccable. The records are absolutely impeccable. And so they could have been nominated My concern is that individuals, particularly those who would be predisposed to think this anyway, would believe that President Biden picked the best black women he could find. When, if one examines their records, he's looking at some of the best attorneys in the United States of America.
Regardless of race, regardless of gender. Right.
And so it's concerning. I mean, if one even looks at their time in law review, Harvard Law Review, Yale Law Review, the law firms at which they worked, or both of them, absolutely top-notch law firms. Their clerkships, everything is absolutely impeccable. They could stand up to anyone who's currently on the Supreme Court, and certainly stand up to anyone who's currently in the federal appellate bench. So And to put it on the flip side, the previous president, for example, I don't think the previous president considered any black women to be on to be nominated to the federal bench. But he didn't say, I'm going to look at Caucasians because that's just what I'm going to do. He picked and they said, oh, well, these are the best people. I think Biden could have achieved the same result. And a more apropos example, if I may, just very quickly, President Reagan. When President Reagan picked Judge Antonin Scalia, who was then a judge on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals in 1986, President Reagan wanted to nominate the first Italian-American to the Supreme Court of the United States. Catholic voters at the time were still a Democratic bloc, but because of the abortion issue were becoming in play. They were coming into play, and he knew that he could get this and that he could get Senator Kennedy to support Scalia because Senator Kennedy needed the Italian-American votes in Massachusetts. President Reagan did not make a show of nominating an Italian-American or only considering Italian-Americans. He nominated Judge Scalia. Everyone agreed that the judge was superbly qualified, and Judge Scalia was confirmed 98-0 to the Supreme Court. And I think President Biden could have done the exact same thing here without making a show of it in the campaign, particularly a show that may have a detrimental effect in the future.
I got you. So you just said you wish that he'd have been quiet and not have made that a campaign promise that he would have selected a black woman to the Supreme Court, or that he wanted to.
Correct. And just say, I'm going to consider everybody, and that everybody has not been considered by previous presidents. I will consider everybody to the court. Because I think,
I can hear your argument. He would have been more artful with his words, I guess. But I guess sometimes people don't hear. And in my opinion, you know, as a publisher, oftentimes even our own readers, God bless them, much as I love them because they are our readers, is that sometimes you have to be very clear that you're saying B-L-A-C-K. Otherwise, they may not hear the word. They just won't hear it. And that's one of the things I hope that we do in this conversation is to further explain hopefully why her nomination is significant. You know, people might think she's just another judge, but what I'm hearing from you, she is a good judge regardless of all of the demographics, but he specifically placed her in a position to rise to the Supreme Court. Is that correct?
Yes, it is, and I think that's a double-ended sword, when one gets placed on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, that judge can often end up with a political target on his or her back. And that's the other thing I have concern about, even though she just took the bench, you know, a couple weeks ago.
I like that, though. You said that she probably have a target on her back. But I think the lady, I can't think of her name off my head, who just took a position at Howard, instead of UNC, I think she would say she had a target on her back since she was in second grade.
Right. Yes, I read that.
Having a target on your back comes with being black in the United States.
Right. I understand, but what I mean more specifically, though, is that one remembers with George, just very briefly, George W. Bush nominated Miguel Estrada, outstanding attorney. Who I do not agree with his legal philosophy at all, but an absolutely outstanding attorney with impeccable credentials, nominated him to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. And Senators Chuck Schumer and Harry Reid blocked it. They completely blocked it, would not allow him to come up to a vote because they knew that if Mr. Estrada got onto the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, President Bush was going to nominate him to the Supreme Court, and he'd be the first Latino Supreme Court justice, and Democrats would not be able to block that. And so that D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, that's what I mean, that it brings such a high profile.
Right. So I guess Biden is fulfilling his at least he's on the path of fulfilling his campaign promise.
Absolutely, with two standing choices, their credentials are unassailable.
Okay, well, let's move on a little bit to your other book on Harry Truman, because you wrote two books on Harry Truman. So, what is it about Harry Truman that attracts you to his administration?
He's such a fascinating figure, personally and politically, in that he did not attend college and went straight to war, and then was thrust into being president of the United States after being vice president for just a few weeks, and then ended up being one of the most consequential presidents that we had. I think that we've had in American history, certainly that we had during the 20th century. And also, I enjoy researching and writing about Harry Truman because I've researched for years and years now. I'm pretty sure that if I were alive at that time, I don't think I would have voted for him. And I think I likely would have voted for Wendell Willkie. And I think that allows me to have a bit of a distance from the subject, and at least I try to present the reader with an honest assessment of the administration and the president and the justices he appointed to the Supreme Court.
Okay, and how has Truman's court appointments affected black lives?
President Truman was the first president to do what we now expect all of our presidents to do, and that is to use the Department of Justice and use the Supreme Court on offense, not just on defense. So every president up to President Roosevelt had defended their policies in the Supreme Court. And, Roosevelt with the court packing and that whole mess that ensued. President Truman was the first president to go on offense. And he did so because he realized that his civil rights agenda would get nowhere in Congress, which the Senate was controlled by the Southern segregationists. So he empowered and charged his Department of Justice with working with the NAACP to pursue that agenda through the courts. And with three nominations to the court and three justices and one Supreme Court justice, four total nominations to the court, he was able to achieve a great deal and became the cases consolidated as Brown versus Board of Education.
Oh, okay. See, I never heard that story before. I never knew him as being so significant with black people, but I knew he was significant. But that's another avenue to explore. So how has Trump's court appointments affected black lives so far, in your opinion?
So far, the voting rights case is really the big blow. At this point, it appears to me that they under the Chief Justice's leadership have rendered, and if they haven't rendered it, they seem intent on rendering the Voting Rights Act a dead letter. And to be fair, that began before they got there, but it is really something to see so-called conservative justices disregard the express will of Congress, which is not a conservative viewpoint. That's a right-wing viewpoint. That's not conservative. That's why it irks me so much. The conservative justice. It's not conservative to overturn the express will of Congress twice. And that's what they've done with the Voting Rights Act cases, and it really is unfortunate.
So what's the distinction between conservative and right-wing?
I believe that the Chief Justice is a true conservative, despite his votes with the Voting Rights Act. I believe he is a true conservative. I think the best contrast would be with Justice Clarence Thomas, who is at least very honest, and he calls out his fellow justices when they try to do it through the side door. He's very honest in wanting to overturn opinions with which he disagrees. He's very honest with his willingness, sometimes eagerness, to disregard the will of Congress because he has his ideas about what the law should be. And the conservative principles of stare decisis and the conservative principle of deferring to the elected branch of government don't seem to concern him or at least impede his thought process. And so that's what I'd say is the difference. I think Justice Thomas is more of a right-wing justice trying to push the court to a certain place as opposed to wanting to move gradually.
Okay. I guess the distinction I'll have to ponder on, but I'm getting there. I pretty much see what you're saying. But and hopefully our listeners are pondering these issues too. We'll see. You also wrote another book about Charles Hamilton Houston and Thurgood Marshall and the struggle to end segregation. Houston is less known. Can you share a few words about him and his relationship with Thurgood Marshall?
Well, Charles Hamilton Houston was just an absolutely brilliant man. At his time, he was the most highly educated African-American lawyer in American history. He was the first editor-in-chief of the Harvard Law Review. He was the first African-American member of the Harvard Law Review. President Obama was the first editor-in-chief of it. Charles Hamilton Houston later became the dean of Howard Law School and then became the first counsel for the NAACP. And he was the architect for the legal movement to end segregation. He laid out the path of how to achieve desegregation because, as you know, the law moves slowly, and they had to get precedent. They had to pick their cases. They had to pick the states. They had to pick the circuits where they would appeal these cases. And Thurgood Marshall was his most prized student, was his best student, whom he later hired to work at the NAACP, and Marshall later took over for him at the NAACP. But Charles Hamilton Houston was just a bedrock of American society who literally worked himself to death working on behalf of the legal fight to end segregation, and did not live to see the day of the Brown versus Board of Education decision. But he really is a pillar who deserves more recognition. I tried to do that with Root and Branch.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, B, and I appreciate your conversation up to this point, and hopefully in the future too, but up to this point, because to me, what I'm getting out of this conversation is that when you go and apply the law, you just don't jump out the window, that you really have to think about not only what the law says, but what court you're going to, how the court's made up, who the politicians are, who are appointing the court, the judges, et cetera.
That's right. There's a way to do it. The reason that Obamacare survived this time, even getting the vote of Justice Thomas, is that the Supreme Court ruled that the plaintiffs did not have standing, so they could not prove any injury. If you have not been harmed, you cannot sue in the United States. This is not it's not a classroom; it's a courtroom, and you have to have an injury for redress. And that's part of what Thurgood Marshall did when he brought in the many people know the famous dolls that were used in the Brown versus Board of Education trials. And even though it was so controversial among the attorneys, many of them did not want to use these dolls and, you know, were angry about it. But Thurgood Marshall said, I have to show injury. I have to show how the children are harmed. And I don't know how else to do that. If you know how to show that these kids are harmed in a way different than these dolls, I'm all ears. But until then, we're bringing the dolls.
Okay, and that's a good detail. That's a very good detail. Interesting. Okay, we have 90 seconds left. And at the beginning of July, Biden has nominated or announced his intent to nominate 30 jurists to the federal bench, 23, about 77% of those nominees are women, and 17, about 57%, are women of color, according to an analysis done by Demand Justice. What do you expect to happen next?
Well, I've been pleased with the way that the nominations have been moving through the Senate. I've been surprised and pleased. The votes are, you know, closer than I think they should be, but I think both parties are a bit to blame to that. You know, 53-40 for Jackson Akinwumi. It's closer than it should be. But I've been pleasantly surprised with the fact that the White House is getting the nominations out. They've got their people vetted, and the Senate is actually taking them up for votes. And I think it's good. It's nice to see the government functioning in that way.
And you expect it to continue to function in this way?
It looks perhaps until there's a Supreme Court nomination.
Okay.
Then all bets are off.
Okay. Juan James, I want to thank you so much for your time, and we hope to share this on Facebook and hope to make this into a story. And we hope that our readers and listeners share this so that people have a greater understanding of the system. Thanks again for your time.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Wayne. I really enjoyed it.
Okay. Take care now.
Bye.
Okay. Who? Omeo. You can throw that away. Yeah. No, because I get that by email. I can call me. I need to stop it anyway. Oh, I hear a token. Oh, that's Afro. Oh, that's Afro. I thought I heard somebody talking. That was Mon. That's Afro. What is it about the equipment? Okay. Yeah, because I can't think like the AT&T, I can't think of what I would need from them either. Because like, if anything about buying something, you can throw that away. Yeah, how you doing? Pretty good. It's not too hot today. Okay, now look out the window. You see it getting dark. Look out the window. Right. Yeah, we got some here today. Because it got real hot yesterday.
Probably so. Because you said the woods. Yeah, because you said the woods are right next door. Yeah, because they live next door to a park. Yep, she's doing okay. You know, I haven't seen her yet. Yeah, because, you know, she barely comes out the house. She comes out the house, she goes straight to her car. You know, some people you just don't see. Yep. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's not a bad person. Okay. Yeah, I'll call Tressie next week. I thought I'll give Tressie a call next week, see how she's doing, or soon. Yeah, he helped me do some clean some brush, and he was smelling like alcohol. He was helping me clean some leaves up and some. He was helping me cut some brush, help me cut some trees down. Now he helped me cut some from, and yeah, and I said he smelled like alcohol. I said, what can I say about that? Now say it again now. Okay. Right. No, I said they buy for real cheap, and then they renovate the house. Right. Well, they fix them up. Well, you know, they paint them, click. Mm. And they paint them, and they fix the siding, fix the roof. Mm-hmm. Well, they update them mainly. Yeah, plus people want to live in a more modern space. Oh, now you need to put new windows in. But, you know, I put new windows here. Not necessarily. The main thing is that you just update it, you know, because things get outdated. I was trying to look, see what's new on the Post Tribune, but it looks like they're going to tear some more buildings down in Gary. That's what I was trying to look for, and I can't see it. Oh, here we go. I found it. Oh no, let me see. Because I don't know what that was, old story, new story. No, that was just a building, old building. This it looks like it's just houses. Yeah, but I don't see it in the paper now. I just saw it You know, the Post Tribune, they organize so crazy. Yeah, I think they did take over, I think. Because it's much better. Yeah. Well, that's the only reason why I was getting the Post, because you wanted to read it. Or you wanted to get it. Because the Post don't have nothing in it. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, the shooting on I-94. Yeah, the shooting on I-94. Mm-hmm. Let me see. It says, oh, 91st Street in Chicago. Mm-hmm. That's what I hear. The people, you on the highway and people shoot at you on the highway. Okay. Everything I see good in the news. Everything else, nothing really big. So Amos lived, he lived in Gary too? Amos Bell. Uncle, granddaddy's brother? Yeah, and Amos Bell, when it... Oh, that's granddaddy's brother, wasn't it? Oh, okay. I didn't know that. You talking about Nope, I can't see nothing else good. Yeah, I'm through. Yeah. It's raining now here. Yeah, the mail is for it to Grace's house.
Thank you. Thank you.